All right, and we're back in studio here for In the Garden on the Farm, part two. We've got a two-hour show every third Monday from 4 to 6, and I'm sending out my aloha. I'm here in studio with our good buddy Zeph, and we're sending out love to Freddie Mango Roots, co-host of the show, who's healing his own horses right now. He's got those horses kicked up and recovering. We're sending you so much healing love, brother, and looking forward to being in the forest with you again. Freddie, along with a crowd of amazing Food Forest family, helped to put on the 10th anniversary celebration we had yesterday at the Food Forest. Zeph, you were there.
Indeed.
What did you see? What did you feel? What did you taste?
Oh, wow. I mean, by far, it was the most number of people I've ever seen at the Food Forest.
That's for sure.
I was certainly blown away. And, you know, having been off island for a year and just being pretty intimately engaged with some of those plants in some areas of the forest, incredible to see how things are thriving, you know, and to really see evidence over the years of distinct growth. And I think having been in the areas of the world that I've been in lately and looking at some of the environmental and practical challenges that come with growing food, especially in forest systems, both intentional and generational, amazing to see the health and the vigor of the food forest here on Kauai. Even just trimming back the Tulsi basil and going, oh my gosh, this is why they call it tree basil. You know, these are trees. This is amazing.
It's such a fun way to garden.
Indeed.
We have such a good time. We're there every Saturday from 10 to 5. You can find out more information at kauaifoodforest.org. Big love to the whole Kauai Food Forest family. I'm thinking about Rob. I'm thinking about Andy. Thinking about Zephyr, Maria Sol, Nate and Ben, Pearl, great food from Natalie, who's been making food for the Food Forest for so many years, bringing the beautiful food, Emily, and everybody there who gave so much time and effort, Dave and Marshall. We had the Food Forest elders there, people who were there who made it happen in the very beginning, Ray Maki. We had Marshall, Paul, and Mark Olson. So many of the Regeneration's board members were present as well. And we love to be together, working hard, working for community and intention. I was really proud of everybody's contributions. And every Saturday, folks, it's going on. We actually prepared a beautiful planting bed and didn't quite get the plants in the ground, but we took care of all of the other necessities. And we're going to be back at it next Saturday, putting some beautiful plants, maybe with a little potting media around the roots. Maybe we'll take the potting media off. I'm still scared, but I'm going to try. Please do consider joining us if you're here on the island of Kauai. KauaiFoodForest.org is how you can get all the info. And yes, you can just show up and we'll put you to work. So really excited to spend the rest of the hour here from 5 to 6 p.m. with my good buddy Zeph, Michael Zeph. You know him as Zeph. And Native to Life is his focus, his passion, his purpose. And it's great to have you here. You did a really inspiring unfolding of that dynamic, that concept of Native to Life before the show. Mm. And I want to invite you to tell us all about you. Where are you from? How'd you get here? What do you love? Mm. And what are you working on?
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you for letting me be here. You know, I grew up in Florida, you know, so I had a upbringing in the tropics, which I think plays a key factor in all of this. And being close to Disney World, you know, I saw every kind of culture I possibly could have imagined. I remember watching people see the ocean for the first time in Daytona Beach and their absolute awe and wonder dropping to their knees and crying, you know? And so all of these experiences led me to, I think, an unspoken awareness that there's a big world out there. And on my 20th birthday, I left and traveled the world. And that began a decade-long adventure, somewhat accidentally, into direct contact with indigenous cultures around the world, in New Zealand and a lot of the areas of Polynesia and in the Hawaiian Islands, and down in South America as well, Ecuador, Colombia, and Peru. And through that journey, I was sitting in 2022, I was sitting around a fire with the Arawak Omamo elders of northern Colombia in the Sierra Nevadas there. And their role, I can say, in a very small drop for the ocean that they do, their role currently is to help humanity bring some things back into balance, specifically as it relates to nature. And we're discussing the role of Western society in the world and the degradation of natural systems and the ways that their lands, their homelands, have been compromised. And I asked, you know, hey, how do you imagine that practically unfolding in the West, in the Western world? And Duavico, one of the brothers there, one of the Mamo elders, he leans up out of his hammock and looks at me dead in the eyes across the fire. And he says, in Spanish, Paul, I'll translate, "Brother, they're not coming out here to the mountains to talk to me, to ask me." He said, "You look like them, yeah? You come from their culture. You speak their language. What are you going to do?" Oh, man. And it wasn't a rhetorical question. We sat there at the fire and talked about it and worked through it. And eventually that brought me to kind of three core concepts that I find as takeaways from the many cultures that I've experienced. Because what I came to realize is, as a Westerner, as someone grown in Western society, my goodness, as soon as I try to step out of that, it's very challenging to know where to go without things like cultural appropriation or stepping on toes or introducing myself into things that I may or may not be welcomed into. Yeah. And so what this conversation brought me to in the coming weeks was a recognition that, oh, okay, each of these cultures is tapping into something. It's not the culture itself per se, especially for me and my upbringing. It's what those cultures are tapping into. And the three key components I've found in that are connection to self, or connection to our humanity, our inner aliveness, connection to nature, the world around us, the outer aliveness, and then connection to the present moment, where the inner aliveness and outer aliveness come together and meet. And that, I find, those three things, which are huge umbrellas, there's so much that goes into those, and there's much more beyond that. Those, I find, are native to life. It's not native to any particular culture, but it's perhaps the bedrock of any successful culture that I, on my own little individual journey, have come across.
Which is why indigenous people, when they gather from around the world, they're like, we're all the same.
Yeah.
Or that there are so many things that they easily relate to each other because of those things that you listed.
Yeah. And it's just like the soil. I hear it over and over and over again around the world. We're all standing on soil, aren't we?
Mm.
You know? And the soils may be different. They have different compositions. Some are depleted. Some are thriving. You know, some have a nice buildup of plant material. Some are bone dry, but it's soil.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're all coming from where we come from.
Right. And we're all humble to the soil, where life springs, all life comes from Mama Aina. So beautiful. Mm. So as you think, so I'm curious to your journey of the question. posed to you by the Mamo Elder. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it?
Man.
And then you guys talked through it. So yeah. what are you going to do about it?
Well, I think,
what do you feel inspired to do?
Yeah, I find that sharing and participating and learning and growing my own capacity for connection to self, connection to nature, connection to the present moment, mm-hmm. and coming together in that, you know, creating spaces where we can practice these things. The irony of it is that those are fundamentally, I would say, generally speaking, fundamentally missing in Western culture. You know, we're typically connecting outside of ourselves, but not to nature, mm-hmm. not connecting to our inner aliveness and utilizing the present moment to get from one place to another, you know, escaping the past or moving towards the future. So to bring those aspects of life back into focus, I think, is very simple. You know, it doesn't require money particularly. And they're readily accessible to all people. So finding ways of doing that, which can look very, very different. I think my interests are oriented around the ways that living and sharing community spaces come together with growing food and creating sustainable food systems and food forests in, you know, anywhere. I think I have my eyes set on Indonesia and the areas that I've been in most recently. Mm-hmm. But it's just as true out here on the Hawaiian Islands and here on Kauai. And there's people doing amazing things like you guys over at the food forest to bring people in, you know, the volunteer days and the ways that people are able to connect with nature via the conduit of working with food and understanding what happens in the soil. And then what happens when we consume these foods and consume these soils mm-hmm. via the fruit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, beautiful. Yes, mm. resonating deeply. Mm. A feeling that the three aspects that you spoke of, what's going on inside me, what's going on in the natural world in which I find myself, everything external to me, and what's happening in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And how can that all be brought into alignment, mm. into balance, the natural balance it wants to achieve anyway? How can I get out of the way? How can I listen? How can I respond? I'm really excited to go on a journey with you for the rest of the hour as we consider these three aspects great interest in all of them. So take us to your most recent journeys in Indonesia and your interactions with the people of those places, and how did these three aspects reveal themselves to you?
Mm, beautiful question. Fascinating, because I started in Jakarta, one of the, for those who aren't aware, one of the most densely populated places on Earth in terms of humanity. In terms of human population, right?
The capital of Indonesia, is
the capital
that right?
of Indonesia,
and
correct.
It's on the island of
Java.
Java,
yeah. It's in you'd say northwestern Java, along the northern coast there. So I went from the concrete jungle and sort of getting swallowed up in it, and fascinated to see, despite being in an intense, wildly active city setting, to notice the level of presence in people. When you ride a moped around millions of people in a crowded city where there are very few rules and regulations to how and where you can drive, I think it develops an incredible capacity for presence. You can't not be, or you'll get swallowed whole. Yeah. So going from there to the starkly different Ujung Kulon National Park, and experiencing what it was to witness the same island, the same area of the island, in its natural setting, and in spaces that were well preserved from any human influence. And from there, moving to, I was particularly amazed by a culture that has existed for a very long time in an area called Badui, And we got to visit. There are two villages, one far more removed from modern society. We went to the more accessible Badui Dalam. And the people there, fascinating encounter with traditional music and traditional bamboo artistry and incredible textiles and natural plant dyes and all this. But something kind of hilarious to me was that this, I'll preface by saying this village does not use electricity. There are no cell phones. They don't allow technology to come in. And I'm walking around and I see in multiple places wind turbines. Windmills.
That's technology.
And they were exquisite. I mean, these were highly sensitive wind turbines that were very, very, very efficient. I was like, hold on. There's no electricity here. What are these powering? And through our walkabout there, I came to a man who was fashioning a propeller for one of the wind turbines. And I asked in the best that I could, you know, through the thick wall of language barrier. I asked, you know, what is this about? What do you use these for? He said, fun. These guys are such incredible artisans that when somebody left the village and saw, you know, an electric wind turbine, they said, I want to do that. I want to check that out. Let's see. And the village has competitions where they'll climb up the pole. It had a bamboo structure and install their own propeller. And they've got a sort of, you know, jovial competition on who can make the best wind turbine for fun. Nice.
Well, that's an energy, right? They're generating fun energy.
Absolutely. There it is. There it is.
Their version of a kite or whatever's.
That's it.
It's so important that we do that. Sometimes we get like, so I've got to work and then I have to eat and then I have to sleep. And it's like, when's the fun part?
Yeah. Yeah. Ideally, we can find fun in it all, huh?
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot
we
of
can.
Fun.
There's something to be said about an activity that doesn't have any practical use. Like, there's too, like, I'm not a big fan of people doing too many things that don't result in something useful. Mm-hmm. But there's something special about something that doesn't result in anything useful other than just the fun of it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't cause any harm.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. You know?
And, you know, working with kids, it's fascinating because something as simple as, say hide and seek or some bizarre game where they're trying to create some fantastical structure appears as though it has no practical value at all, but there's so much learning that can go on in these spaces when we let go of a particular objective. But things I witnessed in working with the children and especially in our nature camps and in connection to nature camps, novel ideas come out of a space in which there's no particular objective, but in the creative process, one says, ooh, how do I get this palm roof onto this structure that I built prior to thinking about the roof? You know, the kids built the structure, they built the walls, and they said, well, it's sunny in here. You know, and so there's immediately these engineering problems and challenges that we can face when we allow ourselves that space to play, right? Mm-hmm. To play. Mm-hmm. Simply to play. Mm.
And from an agricultural perspective of what you were viewing there, you know, agriculture is a serious business.
Oh, yeah.
It's very serious.
Got to have a furrowed brow.
But Maybe I'm stereotyping, but I'm imagining in indigenous cultures, they're having more fun. Mm. Did you hear songs in the fields? Mm. Did you see? Tell me, paint a picture, because this is radio. Mm-hmm. So we have to use our mind's eye. Mm-hmm. We want to be, you're taking us into this rural location in Indonesia. Are you in the mountains? Are you near the ocean? Where are you at?
Both.
You're at both, okay, you fantastic.
Know, for those listening in the Hawaiian Islands, if you close your eyes and you imagine that sunrise that you remember, you know, that one sunrise that you remember is glorious. Imagine that reflecting those who work with kalo or taro, you can imagine the reflection on the lo'i as that sun is rising. And if you imagine that lo'i with just a seemingly endless number of succession plantings on contour as your eye carries down the mountainside, it's an extraordinary wonder to see the rice paddies, the rice terraces, and the ways that these systems of growth surround water, and the ways that people reflect in the rice paddies. The elders are speaking of family, you know, they're speaking of the niece or the nephew who's having a challenge with this or that. And there's this immense reflection that happens while working in the fields or in the rice paddy that I find tremendous. And I saw it time and time again that in these spaces with a lot of water in them, that there is great reflection happening. And in those durian trees that were planted and pruned for ease of climbing. The branches are selected for the capacity to use them like a ladder. And durian, nearly 100 feet high, seemingly, you know, maybe more realistically 60 feet high.
They could be 100 feet.
They very well
could be. They do grow that tall.
Some of those old trees, they really were immense. And to see a man with a smile hop right up into the tree and climb the ladder that he's built and his grandfather started, you know, and to carry on that genealogical ladder up the durian tree with rope in hand to tie the rope around the durian so that when it's naturally ejected, it doesn't fall to the ground and kill somebody. You know, tremendous to witness the ways that what we could call agriculture or food growing happens in these parts of the world, and how much fun they're having.
You know? How old are those now? The rice paddies that you so beautifully described, so I could see them in my mind's eye. I'm familiar with those being a Bali landscape, another part of Indonesia, mm-hmm. but they're throughout the islands of Indonesia. Are they? We're still on Java, though, right?
Yeah, and same is true in Bali. Absolutely, I think it's more well represented in Bali. Okay. But in terms of the cultural distribution throughout the Indonesian islands, that is a very tricky question that I'm not entirely qualified to answer. However, you can see remnants of a very ancient agrarian society all throughout what I experienced in Java and the island of Bali.
Yeah.
And amazing being here in the food forest again and seeing with fresh eyes, seeing the ways in which a food system developed with a methodological approach and, you know, foundations in permaculture and agroforestry and these things are so precious and so beautiful, especially for those coming from a very different Western perspective. I think, you know, many of us participating in the food forest grew up in the suburbs and didn't have access to, you know, fruit trees. And so to have a systematic approach to these things, I think, is really helpful because it's not grounded in our, you know, mm-hmm. early development. Whereas on the other side of the earth, in Indonesia, not for all, but for many, and specifically those who are still cultivating their indigenous ways, people grew up either in the forest or surrounded by food forest systems that have existed for thousands of years, and the plants have just continued their generational successions.
Outrageous. Oh my gosh, I'm loving this. We would need to take the super break, briefest break at the bottom of the hour to let you know you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. The show is In the Garden on the Farm. We are in studio with Zeph, marinating ourselves in the beautiful, comfortable vision of a healthy community in the deepest communion and connection with the Aina, the earth that gives us life. We're going to play this short PSA. We'll be right back with you in just half a minute. Okay, we're back again with Michael Zeff. We know him as Zeff. He is a world traveler, and he's paying attention to the kind of things that matter to us. And that makes it really super interesting to hear his reflections. He's speaking just a little bit ago about the beautiful rice paddies and their, of course, prominence in the agricultural landscape and the cultural landscape, bringing that energy of water into people's lives. And take it from there, my friend.
Yeah. So as I learned, there in Bali specifically, it's Honan on Bali. In northern Bali, I get to spend a lot of time in the rice paddies and learning with local farmers. And I quickly came to realize and was taught about their Subak system, S-U-B-A-K system. And this is a system that has roots from many thousands of years ago for water management and specifically how water travels from the headwaters and from the highlands on the volcanic peaks, of which there are three on Bali, to the ocean and what happens in the process. And immediately, having spent many years in farms and in learning about the landscapes, especially on Big Island, there is a strong correlation between the Subak system in Bali and the Ahupua'a system that I learned about on Big Island. And the ways in which water moves, and specific to Bali, the ways that water determines communal structures, community structures, the way that the movement of water dictates where people have settled and what communities arise from that and what the communal organization is and who's in charge and how things go. And it's given way to the entire social, practically the entire social structure of the Balinese people, including the calendar. The calendar is set around the rice growing seasons. And just extraordinary to witness that, you know.
How different does that feel than Western culture?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, our orientation to water is how much is it going to cost if I take a six-minute shower as opposed to a five-minute shower, right. You know, whereas the showers are free because people are in the river. And probably benefiting from the microorganisms that are, you know, floating by in those clean waters. Yeah, it's immensely different from growing up in the West. Yeah. And in the ways that we treat water, granted, there is a lot of pollution all over the world. And I find something, this is an interesting observation, that in societies quite close to their indigenous roots, and I'll speak to a degree of maybe two generations removed from, you know, the true living reality of their indigenous roots up to those who are continuing those practices today. In that sort of spectrum, I witness a difficulty in the management of pollution, specifically plastic waste,
for sure,
bottles and things like this. And what I observed, this is anecdotal, most definitely, but what I observed is that plastic waste is treated in the same way that an avocado peel is, or a banana peel, or, you know, the skin of an orange, which when we threw it on the ground, it benefited the soil, or, you know, perhaps even spread a seed or two. Yeah, whereas now plastic does quite the opposite, and it's extremely detrimental, and it has longstanding implications, as we're aware. However, I feel that rather than it being a point of lack of capacity to understand these principles, which I think a lot of people jump to, especially when dealing with indigenous societies in the sense that they could possibly be less intelligent. I find that to be absurd, but simply once there's a recognition of the longstanding implications of plastic and how that differs from organic material, there's an immediate movement to clean every little bit of it up. And in the few walks that I did with my partner, picking up trash on the roadsides, there were times that we had 12 kids walking with us, finding any plastic bag that they could to fill it. And then when we drove through those same streets 2 weeks later, there wasn't a spot of trash anywhere, you know? And there's something to be said about just recognition of, oh yeah, that makes sense, you know? And then things change, things shift. So I think oftentimes it's more a matter of education as opposed to the lack of capacity to understand.
Absolutely. We're all highly capable.
Absolutely.
Highly capable. I'm back on the agriculture. We're still in the islands of Indonesia. As someone who lives on a farm with dairy water buffalo here in Hawaii, the water buffalo, how integrated, if at all, is the water buffalo in agriculture?
Ooh, you know, I was there during harvest, so I didn't see much of the ways in which they would utilize the water buffalo. I also didn't see much mechanical use of tractors and things like this. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hands-on activity.
Yes, lots of hands.
Lots of hands, yeah. Okay. And that raises an interesting point there of the challenge of children and young people with access to technology. And the, as you said earlier, rice farming is hard work. And the challenge that has arisen is the lack of motivation or inspiration to do hard work that pays very little. And what we see are farmers that are extremely, you know, old and not much generational succession in that way of young farmers. So there's I witnessed where there was the implementation of newer technology in farming practices, there were also younger farmers.
Nice.
Whereas where the traditions held strong, they were really hurting to find some new legs.
I totally get it.
You know,
I mean, we all, yeah, we rely on our tools. We need labor-saving devices.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you know, from the very early stages of like a sharp rock instead of a dull rock, humans were like, yes, I'll use that for sure. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's critical, and yet it comes. You know, it's finding that place where the traditional practices can be enhanced with these labor-saving devices rather than erased with a tractor that does it a different way and has introduces soil compaction or fuel pollution or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
How can we make these elegant choices? How can we all live a high quality of life?
Mm-hmm.
There's this funny circle where the people from the country come to the city for all of the conveniences and the pay, mm-hmm. you know, jobs, ready jobs, and a certain quality of life enhancement through all those things, which is undeniable. But ultimately, the cities become these wastelands or just highly polluted, dangerous places to be, and nobody can breathe or see the skyline and or the stars or the birds or the fish. And then people come back to the country looking for what they've lost, but then bringing the trappings of the city with them.
Yeah.
I'm speaking personally, my own experience. Yeah.
Yeah,
interesting to see how that's happening, and how can we not take too much from the city?
Mm.
You know, how can we make those appropriate choices of what to bring and what to leave behind?
Yeah,
and how can we raise the vibration of life for everyone, no matter where they live?
And I find it interesting that those of us who grew up in urban or suburban areas and have considered natural systems come around to what we started with of, you know, permaculture, agroforestry, food forest initiatives as a sort of saving grace, you know, to the level of disconnection that we experienced growing up, speaking for myself especially. And I witnessed the same in those who leave indigenous cultures, go to the city, and then come back. They've been informed by the systematic approaches to agriculture that have come to be via, you know, city models and in urban planting and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So quite fascinating to see how that, like you say, that circle, that loop comes back around and people really do reconnect to their roots. But I wonder at how farming and food production can be incentivized. There's some interesting programs in place in Indonesia to try to make farmers more, you know, profitable and to give a better quality of life to those who are literally giving food and bringing life to people. You know, we can't can't live without food and water, and how to make that appealing and something that people can survive off of without breaking their back.
Right.
It's a challenging question.
It is. And certainly strides are made with education, access to education and technology.
Yeah.
So people can learn from what's going on in the world. Yeah. They can learn how to join, you know, the formation of cooperatives and ways in which those farmers can bring their product to market, cut out the middleman, and, you know, make a living wage, but still see the stars, hopefully.
And
live on those roads that you saw with no trash, and places that people take pride in and take care of. And of course, there are places in the city like that where people do as well. And thriving urban gardens.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to love this planet no matter where we live. There's soil under our feet no matter where we are.
Yeah. And I remember in Colombia, so jumping to South America, a food forest initiative that was created, it was a community garden, and they had a section of it that was food forest. They had an initiative to reconnect the youth with indigenous and culturally significant ways of growing food that come from that area in sort of south central Colombia. And it was incredible to witness some of the merging and melding of Western approach and native approach to food growing. And specifically, I think this relates to the food forest here, specifically in the way of creating seed banks and being able to sort of rehabilitate the population of not just native species, but also species that work really well in their soils and in their climactic region, and companion planting and all of this kind of stuff. They have these beautiful spiral garden beds that they worked with because it maximized cross-pollination and these different things and minimized.
And they're fun.
And they're fun. There it is. Why not walk in a spiral instead of straight lines? I saw very few straight lines there, mostly everything on contour. Even coffee farming, you know, was an incredibly different experience over there. Coffee was interplanted in agroforest systems and, you know, mostly shade grown, which if you see that on the bag of roasted coffee, you know that you're paying a little extra.
Right.
Typically.
Right.
You know, shade grown coffee.
Right. And it's like, why is it better? And then you go there and you see the environment where it's growing and you're like, that's why it's better.
Yeah. You know, and coffee beans roasted over an actual fire and being smoked, you know, by specific types of wood. And it was just incredible to witness, you know, what goes into it. Why is it different?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been so lucky to live with a woman who is with the special relationship of cacao and experiencing her hand process. And it's really, it's deep and it's like, it's so there's so much presence to being held by her when she makes it, and the hands-on approach and all that kind of thing. In your journeys, did you see any cacao farming going on? And can you share anything about what you saw and experienced?
Absolutely, yeah. Specifically in the Sierra Nevadas of northeastern Colombia. When I was with the elders I spoke of earlier and we were around that fire, that whole week we were planting cacao, avocado, coffee, and a few other fruit trees, and clearing a lot of space for in another area where the canopy had grown sufficiently that we're starting to prep for the understory and the succession planting, you know, that we witness in permaculture. I myself alone planted over 100 cacao trees over the course of that week, and it is a cash crop, so there's multiple interests as to why that was chosen. Yeah. From the indigenous roots to the fact that it can be a very valuable resource to those families. Fascinating to see how they prepared soil. They used basically a 1:1 to 1:1 ratio of ash, wood ash, compost, wood chips, and soil harvested from the area that they would be planting. Basically 25% of each, mix that up with compost, and they would make that mix, and then the second mix was compost and manure, 50-50, that they would combine with that 25% mixture of each piece. Uh-huh. So they'd have two, compost and manure, 50-50, and then the other four being wood ash, fresh wood chips, local soil, and the fourth one there, and then mixed that all together, dropped it in the hole, and stuck the tree in the ground.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how were they getting their wood chips?
They were breaking it up by hand and by axe.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not quite the wood chips that we're used to. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And worked just fine.
Yeah, it worked just fine. It created just enough dynamic within the soil to, give the roots something to bind to and something to work around.
Right.
Yeah.
That recipe was not arrived at by accident.
No.
It was like at a certain point along the way, there probably wasn't the wood chip in there. And then they were like, it's not right yet. Mm-hmm. What does it need? Mm-hmm. What in nature would provide that function?
Yeah.
Oh, the wood.
Yeah.
Or they observed that, like, when this branch, oh, humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The human experience of observation and following nature's example is just so brilliant.
And following nature's timelines, yeah. Because to make those, what we can call wood chips wasn't a very efficient process if you consider time. Mm-hmm. But that's not one of the matrices that is most important in these sort of cultures. You know, it's okay to, like a craft, like a beautiful painting, to take as much time as is necessary to render it fully. And I found that to be very inspiring as it related to farming. There wasn't a rush, you know. At most, there were seasons and cycles to be considered. And the moon is here. Let's go. You know, however, in general, I didn't notice a huge need for expediency,
right,
relative to time, you know. So those wood chips could take a month to, chop up little by little each day, and that's okay, you know. In the meantime, there's many other things we can do.
Plenty.
You know.
Wow.
Very fascinating. I think typically in the Western mind, we go with expediency, we go with scalability, of these systems. And some of these systems would not hold up at large scale.
Yeah.
But on the small scale where they're actually being applied, tremendous.
Yes.
Tremendously functional.
Absolutely. Small farms, small producers are vastly, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's like something crazy, like 80% of the world's food comes from small farms, not these big ones that we see on the product brochures and all that kind of. It's all the people breaking down the wood into little pieces in the in the timelessness of time, when we live by a different sense of time and a different sense of place and belongingness. And it's so beautiful that you've had a chance to experience that deeply in various places. We're here in studio with Zeph. Michael Zeph is here sharing his experience of indigenous connection with themselves, the present moment, and the earth around them. We've got just a few minutes before the end of the show. A World of Jazz is coming up at 6 o'clock, and it's been a great time with you, and you've been sharing the possibility that you may be beginning a project or in some way locating your energy, service, donation, relationship down in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. I hope you don't go real soon, but it's great to have you in our community for however long you're here. But as somebody who is coming from the Western culture, you spent time down there. When you imagine really setting in some roots in one of these, what could be considered a far-flung place, is there anything as a person of the modern world that it's scary to you to consider doing that? Something you might be giving up, the comforts of the modern society? Once you really set in your roots, you're inviting in a big change. And what part of it for you is at your edge? What puts you at your edge there?
Yeah, I would say, you know, in reference to what you described there, I've found ways to minimize what I need to such an extent that I've been able to go around the world and do this. Otherwise, financially and things, it would not be viable. So I've been pretty far removed from comfort, I would say. So that's less of an issue. I love a good dirt floor, a good bamboo floor, you know. I think one of the biggest issues, and this was something that I became very quickly privy to in the Hawaiian Islands, and being so fascinated with Hawaiian culture and spending 2 years in a halau in Puna on the Big Island, I came face to face with the reality that no matter what, culturally, there are immense sensitivities, and I have a very delicate placement relative to cultures that know themselves in a very, very deep way. Yeah, as a Westerner who is sort of not in touch with any particular cultural taproot, it can be a very humbling experience, I would say, to step into a space and be welcomed into spaces of indigenous cultures. And I think my edge is in acknowledging the delicate balance between listening and participating, you know, in the cultural traditions, and surrendering my sense of knowing anything, you know, because those knowings are always based on all of the trappings of the past,
not the present moment.
Correct.
Beautiful. Well, I hope you'll send us a postcard so we know where to find you.
Oh, yeah. It's a special place out here, and I know that this is a very fertile. These are very fertile grounds for these kinds of conversations here in the Hawaiian Islands as well.
Truly. And it sounds like maybe you're holding the vision of making the connection that you're making there available to others as a learning piece.
Most importantly, I feel. Yeah. Yeah. Specifically those coming from Western culture, but realizing that, like Swiss cheese, there are holes in it. And that there are ways to, you know, go beyond what we've learned and to really find new old ways.
Beautiful. Let's do it together. I love it. Nice. Hey, thank you everyone for joining us for the show today. Thank you to our special guest in studio, Michael Zeph, a.k.a. Zeph, here contributing to the vision that we're holding for a return and to the present moment. Mm. Returning to the present moment with all the wisdom of the indigenous ways and creating a new way based on what works.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ro.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much to Linda Chalker Scott, our guest in the first hour. And we are here every third Monday from 4 to 6 p.m. The show is in the Garden on the Farm. And big shout out to Freddie Mango Roots. We'll see you in the studio next month. And join us again next month for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.